see so many possibilities.
Oh,
you could get better.
I guess you could eventually pick up a
few.
Oh, you don't go that direction? The pig is a prosecutor.
That's my rough draft of the compilation. And my thesis for it.
Sounds like conviction to me.
What's that?
Sounds like conviction.
Yeah.
Me too. Well, we're in lesson 27. Just had begun talking about these temporal positive phrases. And we can't assign anything yet for it, so we'll give you a three today and get started with the exercise. So we get to the point of assignment. Remember that we're talking about only in the narrative sequence now. And within a narrative sequence, we can use the verb haya to introduce a temporal modifier, a temporal clause, I should say, which will be modifying the meaning. And it's got a very adverbial type of tense. And the translations in English are, you can go to a fairly literal one, it's not too bad. We talked about yesterday, but at the first glance, it's a bit different the way we think and we look at things. So what you can do then is if you're dealing with a past tense narrative, if you're dealing with a past tense narrative sequence in which you're using imperfect forms, in a converted form, then the form will be yhe. And if you're using, if you hear me pronounce it yhe instead of yhe sometimes, realize that when I learned Hebrew at the U, that's the way we pronounce the O there. There's slightly different approaches to vocal and silent shawaz. And I pronounce the shawaz, so if I revert to that once in a while, don't worry about it. The way his book is written, you pronounce it like he with the silent shawaz because you have a short pop out here. So just to let you know, that's not necessarily always the way you I should have asked Elias, should have paid attention to how he pronounced it. But small matter. Anyway, you'll use this converted form if you're dealing with past tense narrative, and if you're dealing with future or habitual durative narrative, where you started out with an imperfect and now you're continuing to convert a perfect, then you of course use what I got. So it just stands to according to the normal rules on sequences. Now looking at the examples, so we know we got through all of these. We got started with them. Why he Baboker wish Wayishlak, and it was in the morning he sent. The way they're translating it literally be something like, and it was in the morning and he sent, and it was in the morning and he sent. If you can see that idea in English very well, I think you can translate it that way. Or Wayhi Akarei Hadevarim Ha'ela Wayishma Kol, and after these things he heard a voice. Literally. Something like, and it was after these things that he heard a voice. Okay, it came to pass after these things. That's kind of what the King James will often render these phrases in a narrative. Wayhi ka'asher ra'a otham wayigra, and when he saw them, he cried out. Or, and it was when he saw them that he cried, and he cried out, or it happened that when he saw them, we figured out a way for this yesterday, I think.
And it was when he saw them.
Yeah, but the problem is that
we put it
to get the and there, yeah. I'm trying to get a translation that will keep the and on the last part.
And it was when he had seen them.
It's almost like you could say the situation was this, and he saw them, and he cried out, So, you have to get a little bit, you have to strain a little bit for English. The problem is only in English, not in Hebrew. You can just do it there, that's the problem at all. Okay? And now going to a sequence that's a habitual durative sequence here.
Well, you could say, when it had been that he saw them, and it was the state that he had seen them, and he cried out.
Yeah. Or something like, you say, and it happened that he saw them, and he cried out.
Yeah.
Like that.
This last verb here, kara, that is continuing sequence.
Yes.
That's why it's in the imperfect.
Right, that's why it's in the imperfect. See, the whole thing, you're assuming that this is embedded in the sequence, so the verb previous to this was probably... Well, you could have started the series with the YE here, I suppose. You could have had a perfect and then started the sequence with this one. But the verbs following are going to continue the sequence. So once you start with these temporal clauses here, you're going to continue the sequence if you're in the same, if it's a converted the imperfect form, then you're going to have the verb in imperfect form.
So the ra'ah is in the imperfect form?
Yes, that's well known to you. Yes, that's because that is not a part of the main sequence anymore. That's a kind of incidental thing.
It's part of the phrase.
Right, it's kind of a phrase. As far as the sequence element is concerned, the YD is keeping it in the sequence. And then this other phrase is kind of in parentheses under that, and it's not breaking the main sequence. It's kind of a subordinate clause to the main sequence. And then you pick up the Z. That's perhaps part of why they say it this way, so they can keep this thing from breaking the main sequence. You see, if you didn't have a YD here, suppose you just started out saying, Asher ra'ah otam. You could not use a converted perfect anymore, and you still get the same meaning because, let's see, and when he saw them, he cried out. Well, I guess the problem is mainly on the other end. If you want to continue a sequence that you've already started, not break the sequence and have to start it over again, and you want to keep this YD thing and then make the other thing subordinate to it. So you're setting up a parenthesis, as it were, and not doing any violence to your main sequence. I seem to like that. Maybe there's a sequential inertia that gets developed where you don't like to break it up unless you have to.
So if I'm in one of these type of sequences and I'm starting off with a perfect,
mm-hmm.
and I switch over and go to imperfect, if I have a temporal clause and one sticking there, I always put it exactly perfect.
No, if you started out with perfect and you converted to imperfects and you've got a temporal clause, now you're on these imperfects, you'll use YHE and that will be your... You'll stay with an imperfect for the YE, but then...
Yeah, the rest of it.
Okay, the rest of it. Okay, then you'll go back to a perfect, or you go back to whatever sense you really want. In other words, if it says, and when he saw them, he cried out, then you do that. Or if you want to say, and when he will see them, he will cry out. Or when he will see them, he cried out. That wouldn't really make any sense. But
so that verb in that temporal clause, and you had your choice in which you want to put it.
Right. The verb in the temporal clause is going to be an unconverted verb form. In other words, it's going to be translated however form you pick. If you pick a perfect form, it'll be perfect translation. If you pick an imperfect form, it'll be imperfect translation. In other words, it's not a part of the sequence anymore. It's kind of a subset to the sequence. So it's theoretically possible to start a new sequence within that. In other words, you're within that clause. I mean, if you want to say when he saw them and he met them and he just talked with them, he cried out. Then you'd have this whole temporal sequence. You could start out with a saw and then put the other two verbs in the imperfect there within the sequence in that, and then come back up here to the main. Narrative and so forth. Yeah, it would be. So, I doubt that you'd ever see anything that complicated in Hebrew. Okay. So, but the main point to establish here is that you're going to a normal perfect ra'ah here just because you're following this ka'asher and you've got a subordinate clause here to what's going on. We haven't really talked about subordinate clauses and other things in much detail yet. We'll get more of that later on. Okay, then if you're following along if you started out your whole narrative with an imperfect and you've got either a future or a habitual dirtis, so you see these last two examples. Wahaya ki tishma'u efadivarim ha'ela uzakartem. And whenever you hear these words, you shall remember. Okay. Again, whenever you hear these words, you're starting with wahaya, and then notice that what's that verb tishma'u? What kind of verb form is that? Perfect or imperfect?
Imperfect.
Yeah, imperfect. Because that's you started the clause with ki, and whatever follows that ki is not part of the main narrative now. The yhi is the wahaya is taking the place of putting this in the main narrative, putting this whole thing in the main narrative. And now, after the key, you're going to have to use the forms of the verbs that are appropriate. And in this case, it's going to be an imperfect form. And then, whenever you hear these words, you shall remember. Now you're going back to the converted perfect again. Uzakartem. And why is it a shurik there instead of wood? Yeah, because of the shua, the first syllable. You wouldn't have, you don't want to shua in the room. Okay, uzakartem. Okay, so whenever you hear these words, you shall remember. Now it's possible, I suppose, say, and when you heard these words, no, I guess it wouldn't work out that way. Whenever you heard these words, you shall repent. You're probably not going to try to say something that way. I'm just saying that it's possible to have, after the key, you could have another perfect there too, I suppose, in certain circumstances, if you were trying to say something in the past tense, completed action idea. But now that I look at it, I wonder if you'd ever be following along in it. See, when you're following along with a narrative that's either future or habitual derivative, it's unlikely it will be going back to past verb forms anyway. Because of the meaning of what you're trying to say.
So, are we saying something like, and it will be that you will hear these words and remember?
Right. Yeah, and it will be that whenever you hear these words, you will remember. That you will hear these words and you will remember. Mm-hmm. That'd be fine. And just putting that, it will be, that sets your temporal situation.
And then we're justified to render that in because of the key.
I think so, yeah. Remember that we're not making real exact translations here either, even when we do that, because it's a different kind of a...
Right. Well, it seems to me it was and it will be. Mm-hmm. It's a sufficient enough.
That's the best I can think of for rendering it. The only problem we had was with this one example. You saw them, he cried out. The only one we had a little bit of awkwardness in trying to make it read, but even there, if you supply some other word, state of being or something like that, you can still work it around.
But you can still do it, it'd just be choppy. Mm-hmm. And it was, he saw them, mm-hmm. and he cried out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the case that he saw them.
Now, now you got it. It was the case that he saw them, and he cried out. That fits real well. But you're still adding the case that, or, mm-hmm. and it'd be choppy, like you say, if you didn't do that. But you still can get the idea from it. I'm just trying to find something you can try to relate to in your language.
Well, you can even think that, and it was the case that it was in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay, you can make that your new equivalent. Okay.
Could you say again what you were saying about it? What happened when he showed up in the sentence?
Whoa, what happened? You mean what happened in the next verb form?
Yeah. What? In other words, why the significance? Why the switch?
In a temporal modifying clause like this, what you're trying to do is make a clause. Set a time relationship for the other. It's very much like a circumstantial participle or even a genitive absolute in Greek, where you're trying to designate the time of one action in relationship to the time of another action or another situation. And so to do that, to make a whole phrase now, putting it into a sentence that just is going to help you get a time value for the rest of the action. This is the mechanism that's using to do that, and the phrase that you stick in may indeed have its own verb form. But you're wanting to make this whole thing be a part of a sequence narrative, and so you're kind of taking a parenthesis here to tell you something about the time value of this thing. And so the key is introducing that. First, the wuhaya is telling you, and it will be that, it will be, and then the key is kind of saying that, it's kind of telling you what will be.
Mm.
And then the rest of that clause is going to be just an ordinary sentence without any sequential rules involved. That if you want to say it in the imperfect, you say it in the imperfect. Whenever you will hear these words, or whenever you hear these words, you will, and that's the phrase. Now you go back to the main sequence and say, you shall remember.
Aren't these the same kind of functioning as adverbial modifiers?
Mm-hmm.
They're all modifying verbs.
Right, exactly. Exactly. See, the main verb in this sense is you shall remember. And now we're wanting to say, at what time or under what conditions or whatever, you see, that's all going to be thinking. In effect, how shall you remember? How, who, what, when, where, why, how, wherever it goes. You see, these adverbial questions that can be answered here. And so, and the answer is whenever you hear these words. That's when, and this is actually answering the question, when will you remember? Whenever you hear these words, you shall remember. And so the whole phrase, whenever you hear these words, is a temporal clause. It's telling you a time, it's giving you a time base for the action.
So actually in the English, if I were to put a comma between and whenever and words and you, that would give me the
the idea of what you're trying to say. And you shall remember blessed words.
Yes.
And when
okay.
you shall.
That's not too bad. And comma, whenever you hear these words, comma, you shall remember. Okay. That might be good to use commas because that will set that phrase off for you, and that's effectively what the Hebrew is doing by using he here and by using this verb hayah to introduce the temporal modifier. The term verb hayah is telling you we've got a temporal modifier here, and then the key is in this particular one is introducing the actual temporal modifier itself, although key may not always be involved. If it's a prepositional phrase, it just may be a preposition. If it's kasher,
so there's other things that can mark these
phrases. Right. There's other things that can mark these. Now, the one just above it is kasher that's marking the phrase. See? And in the one above that, it's the preposition akare, after these things. And akare hadevarim, I guess, totally. And then the first example, in the morning, is in, but, preposition but. And it was in the morning. So there'll be different things that'll mark that actual phrase. And the phrase may involve a subject, verb, and so forth. It'll be a whole sentence, or it may just be a word. If it's morning or evening or something like that, or it may be what else do we have? I guess just a word, a phrase, or a whole sentence. Any of those can be temporal. That's why it says temporal clauses and phrases. The clause involves subject and object and so forth, all the sentence structure. The phrase would just involve one or more words. Yes.
Another question here. In this first example here, in the morning he sent.
Mm-hmm.
If I was first looking at that, I'd attempt to say, and in the morning, and he sent because of the wa.
Right.
Why are we giving you translation value to the wa?
Well, it's because it depends on how you set it up in English. Like Jim suggested, if you translate it like this, and it was in the morning, and he sent, then you can get an and in there even in English. It just has to do with the way that languages are set up. So, in other words, in the Hebrew, the and is there. In English, we don't normally put an and in circumstances like that, although we can set it up and it was in the morning and he sent, although if you talk like that all the time, people will probably think you're illustrating. It's understandable. But it's more akin to the Hebrew idea here. That's the Hebrew thought pattern. And so what I'm trying to say, I would actually prefer you to think in a Hebrew thought pattern, and even if it's a little stilted in English, rather than just drawing an equation in your mind saying, why he, Baboker, why Yishlach means that in the morning he sent. I'd rather not have you draw that equation, even though you might, in fact, translate it that way and given for a given purpose. I'd rather have you think of it more in terms of it, and it was in the morning and he sent, just because I want you to start thinking in the Hebrew thought pattern rather than always trying to find some English equivalent for it that may miss something. First thing, something, lose things in translation. One of the areas which that could conceivably happen. The main reason for that is that I want you to have some sort of a basis that will always be right, will always be accurate. Some situations, if you go to paraphrase type translations all the time, you're going to find that paraphrase translations will vary from place to place and situation and context and so forth, and you can't translate something the same every time. If you go to a more literal translation, you'll probably be able to translate it that way all the time and then pay the consequences as far as meaning afterwards. That's kind of the way I'd rather approach it. If you can get the literal idea, then I'm not so worried about your ability to make that understandable in a paraphrase. But if a person never gets the literal idea and all he has is paraphrases, then he won't get in trouble. It's like Greek prepositions. If you only know about the lots of different ways that pros can be translated, for example, and all you know is it can mean this, this, and this, and this, and this, and then you come along to a particular passage and you say, well, I think it means this in this passage, and you translate it that way, you may have missed the mark completely, because what you're just been used to paraphrase translations of something. You haven't really gotten the concept of what the Greek preposition itself is trying to show in the Greek language. And so you can be misled and get the wrong application for it unless you know what the real idea is involved in the Greek and then translate it. So go from Greek first to English, go from Hebrew first into English. And I think it'd be a lot safer.
Kind of like the, what would you call it? Fallacy of, fallacy. Oversimplification, create a new one.
Uh-huh.
Where, I've oftentimes heard, well, middle voice means self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
which it doesn't mean.
Mm-hmm.
It means intimate involvement with the action.
Exactly.
Oftentimes for self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
But you start throwing every middle voice into a self-interest mode.
Yeah.
You get some weird doctrines real fast.
Yeah.
You know.
Now you have to define it in such a way that it's going to cover all the cases. And in other words, you're trying to get a root idea for the concept. And the root idea of middle voice is that in some way the one who is receiving the action and performing the action, or in other words, in some way the one who is performing the action is involved. Let's say, put it this way: the action is done by someone with reference to himself in some sense.
Yeah.
Even though it might be
the agency of a third party.
Exactly.
The parents had the child taught.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't teach the child.
Right.
They sent the child to a school.
Exactly.
To teach the child.
So they performed an action that the child was taught. You know, they were involved in the action of the teaching, but not directly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a difficult thing to define because our language isn't set up that way. In Greek, if you're thinking of Greek all the time. That would be really funny to have been brought up on Greek and then look at the English and see how they're trying to deal with the middle voice. For you, middle voice, no problem. And then the Englishman's got all this trouble trying to get something equivalent to the middle voice. Okay. So the languages are funny. You have to realize that it's not one word to one word. It just doesn't work on every case. But what we need to do is really start to think in the language we're dealing with. Be faithful to the language and not to just keep trying to digest it down into English and make English the sole reference point for everything. So in the rest of this book, you're going to see more of this kind of thing. So far, we've been able to do pretty much a lexical translation word for word because we haven't really been dealing with clause relationships and function words. Now that we're going to start getting into functional relationships, now we're going to have to start getting our minds geared and oriented towards thinking in the Hebrew pattern. It's going to take a certain transition, you know, but I think you're going to be far better served in the future in terms of really coming with that accurate exegesis if you are able to start seeing the Hebrew thought pattern and then going to English. Okay, now be that as it may, that's part of the reason for spending a lot of time with translation and reading in the second year, reading the text, translating it, asking and talking in class. We're not just going to be going sailing through reading it and then, you know, just for pronunciation, we can do that at home. But what we're going to be doing is going through and analyzing the grammar as we go through. In other words, as we read, as we're reading in Genesis and we read a certain sentence and we see an interesting grammatical feature, we'll take time to comment on it and so forth. And I'll be asking you questions about why is this way and why is this that way and so forth. So it's reviewing, bringing to mind all the rules that we've seen and learning the whys and wherefores. And that's in the process, the reading, the exposure, and so forth, it's going to do more for getting you into Hebrew thought pattern than anything I can think of.
They just won't have to deal with what they did at Qumran. They had special lobbers where they had to take a complete bath before they could test the book. Call up operations.
Yeah,
right. Oh, boy.
We have to get a whirlpool bath on the go.
Right, floor. Yeah. Well, we thought we'd modernize a little bit here and make it a jacuzzi.
Okay. It isn't the right frame of mind for Andrew. Relax and so forth. It was kind of a laid back language. Okay. Note that either a clause or a prepositional phrase may occur in this position. We just talked about that. The most frequently met conjunctions are ka'asher, when or as. And of course, that's a very obvious one because you're dealing with time relationships. And key, when or whenever, when is used in a time relationship, has usually got the kind of translation. Key, as you well know, has got a lot of different translation values. And we haven't even begun yet with key. But in a temporal relationship, in a temporal clause, it's the information that is the time context that's giving when aspect for key. In other words, key doesn't mean just when or whenever. In other words, you can't look at the key in the dictionary and say, it means when or whenever, period. Because sometimes it won't mean that, it'll mean that, and so forth. We've already seen it used in other ways. So that's another case in point, what I'm getting at. You can't just come up with one word equivalent for another word. The key means key, you know? And within its own context, and then in English we may be seeing places where he is used in a situation where English will use when or whenever, or otherwise we'll use that or something like that. Time words such as yom, shana, and eight, meaning time, are common with the preposition the. So in the time that, or in the day that, or in that year, or so forth, those are very common temporal phrases. Okay, and then also nikkei, at the end of, or after, at the end of these things, or after these things. That's very common too, especially in narrative. Rarely a participial clause occurs requiring English conjunction while. So you don't see too many participial clauses. Here's an example. Waihi him omadim sham waishma waishma. They and omadim standing. So how would we do this?
They were standing there.
Yeah, it was that they were standing there, and
they heard.
Yeah, or it came to pass that they were standing there, and they heard. Okay.
So what do they call it? We're standing.
That's a participle.
Yeah, in English.
In English. Oh, they were standing.
We're standing.
I really don't know what they say in English.
It would be not a gerund. The ing would be just probably a past participle, I would guess.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. We're standing. So the one with the were would indicate that. But it's hard for me now to relate to English because I've been thinking to speak English for so many years. It's terrible. I'll have to take that English refresher.
Now, it's
English is so illogical.
But I'm just thinking now. My daughter's in fifth grade. She's learning all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I was talking about what I think of the
day. Our standing would be a present word.
I didn't understand why I didn't know what it was.
Simple,
that. And I said, well, we have something like that in Hebrew that divides us.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what kind for sure.
Yeah. It's starting to come back now that we're talking about English. That's one of the major mechanisms in English is these auxiliary verbs. It's helping words, as they call it. And you're having to get your feet standing. It could be are standing or we're standing. The only difference between the two is the auxiliary verb. You're drawing the tense idea from that.
Now, if they would have had a participle for shama, would it be, and they are standing and are hearing, like in a...
Oh, yes, you could make that a compound, but that would give you a sense of like, and while they are standing and are hearing, then you're expecting something else.
Yeah.
So, you know, it has to be something else. You don't just... A temporal modifier is going to never stand by itself. A temporal phrase is going to never stand by itself. That has something else.
Do they do the same thing like in Greek? And look, he is going to so-and-so and doing this.
Now, there are places where in Greek it's almost as though, but I'm not sure if it's indigenous to Greek or if it's something that has been carried over from Hebrew idiom. But you do, in fact, see that. You'll see them, they'll revert back to the present tense, something, and look, and behold, and it's talking about a past narrative. It says, and behold, you know, and Jesus says, and so forth, then he'll use the present tense for it. And obviously, the whole thing is really past tense narrative. And I suspect that. I haven't had the opportunity to check this, you know, in like classical Greek or anything like that. See if they customarily do this. Greek may do the same thing that Hebrew does, or it may be that the people who wrote the New Testament were speaking Greek, but they were Hebrew people, and their thought patterns may have run along the same lines. We know that's the case in other Hebrew idioms. In other words, we definitely see Hebrew idiom in Greek that's not characteristic of the thought.
I mean, you have those interesting little things where it tells you, Eli, Lama, Shabbat.
Yeah, right. I would like to see. I'll just throw this out for consideration. This came up the other, you know, today in some other context too. I think I was talking to Gerhard about something. But I would like to see somebody do a master's thesis or something on the interrelationships between Greek and Hebrew. It had to be somebody that had both Greek and Hebrew, probably after the second year. But to look at things like this, Hebrew idioms in the Greek New Testament, going deeper than say. Just a matter of tons of things or something, you know. Yeah, look at that. But I think more interestingly would be the grammatical relationships,
right.
Clause relationships,
right.
Things like this. Any evidence of while consecutive type of thought patterns in the New Testament?
Yes.
In terms of the way that things are strung together and so forth. There's probably not going to be a whole lot in a lot of books on it either. Maybe even in there. There's not too many books that are really talking about interrelationships in Hebrew. So some of the basic Hebrew idioms you can see, and some of the hermeneutics books mention these, of course. I'm talking about going beyond that if you want to do a grammatical analysis.
Is there a Hebrew translation of the Greek New Testament in existence?
I'm sure there is.
The library.
The Elias had one for modern Hebrew. And
the Jesus.
Yeah.
Well, Pastor, you're going to do it.
James had one?
In the bookstore, Hebrew New Testament translation.
So does it just give a Hebrew text with the Greek, or does it just give Hebrew and English? Hebrew and English, okay. So there's one in the library there. I haven't really taken time to look at these spots. But there certainly is, and it would be in the script. It would just be a translation like any other translation. It would be inspired.
Maybe
that
was done, too.
Yeah.
Probably done.
It's interesting to see how much vocabulary this has to, that there was one of both of the vocabulary. Of course, it depends on when the translation was done, too. If the translation was done in 100 AD, you know, you see different vocabularies. Well, so this is probably, we want to spend a little time with it because it is a little bit strange, and it's kind of an introduction to a whole new realm that we're going to be dealing with as far as cause relationships. And we'll be in the exercise of looking at enough of them, so we'll try to just keep calling their attention to what's happening. All right, section 111, feminine nouns ending in F and A. These behave much like the segulates in the singular before suffixes. So in singular forms, before your suffixes, they're going to act like the segulates did. So givereth, for example, becomes givirti, my mistress, for putting the suffix on. And da'at becomes dati. And Bosheth becomes Boshti. So what's happening basically is that, at least for these last two, that first syllable is getting closed with a short vowel on it, and the short vowel, you may not know what to predict what it's going to be. Just like with the segulet. You got a closed, you know, like non small key. You don't know where small key or is going to be, you know, milky or what over to the other. I mean, milky, I guess, there's mainly the here. I don't know, but some of them had complement too, but they had both. That's the same problem you're having here. Now with this givereth, this little, you do have the d on the front of that, kind of disregard that for the purposes of this. It's givereth, so you get a here it there. And the other one with da'at, you get patat. And with bosheth, you get boshti, you get complement too. So it's basically the same kind of thing. And again, just like with the others, you won't know unless you look it up in paradigm or the vocabulary gives it or something like that, what the pattern is based.
So you would know that with the comma is because...
The shawa and the closed, yeah.
Because there's no method.
No method, right. There'd be a method there otherwise.
Otherwise you might confuse it with
the comma. Probably, you know, this pattern, you start to recognize these patterns after a while. And you can see, well, this is... Sometimes if you are deceived by that, but sometimes you don't even have to look for a method. You're just sensing that becomes tattoo. Just because you recognize that pattern. Okay, also to this group belong the nouns with penultimately stressed construct forms. So if you get penultimate stress of the construct, you're going to get a similar situation because it, in effect, this. The situation with segulus was that they had penultimate stress, regardless of the particular vowels involved. And here you have words that are penultimately stressed, and they may have additional syllables in them, like milchemeth, for example, from milchamah. Milchemeth was the construct form, and you have a closed syllable mil on the front. If you take the mil off, you just have temeth, and that would be just like any other segulus. So you still keep the mil on there, but then you get milchamti. And if you took the middle off that, it'd be Kamti. Again, it'd be a pop-out type and so forth. So it's pretty much the same. And then Milakha, that's a little bit different, more difficult because of the quiz and all of it. But you get Milakhet, and no last T. And if you just ignore the quiet and all, you get the same situation here. Okay, then the noun bot has a stem bit before the suffixes. So this one changes quite a bit because the whole vowel changes. So the word bot means daughter. If you want to say my daughter, it's not bati or bati or something, it's bitti. Bitti. No way to predict that. It's just the way it is. Okay, that's why you have to single it out. Okay, and then isha before suffixes appears as ishti and ishiteka and so forth. So ishteka, excuse me. And so basically they're just telling you that you get the tau instead of the hay on the end, and then you this one you do keep the yurt. It's looking very much like give your T up there. The yurt closes in both syllables. Pattern. So it looks kind of, the reason we put it in here is it looks like some of these things are okay, the attachment of suffixes to the plural stem of these nouns offers no special problems. Other than knowing what the plural stem is. Okay. But there's no real exception. Now, here we come to one of the most unusual and irregular types of nouns there are. The nouns of the type puri, fruit. It is difficult to formulate rules for the small class of nouns other than to note the replacement of the final long vowel by a consonantal yod. So this is consonantal, it means it's got a consonant sound. Not a mater or the hieric yod type of situation. Before the light suffixes in the finger. There is, however, much inconsistency, especially in the form of the plural. Following sampling, the tested form should enable the student to identify nouns of this class when encountered. So this is just a sampling of the tested forms, and so for these nouns, you're not seeing the whole forms, you know, or the whole paradigm, because these are the only ones that are tested. So you'll also see in number 861 or 863 or something back here, in your same thing is pretty much reproduced back here someplace. Okay, 31. 31 A, B, and C. Page 294. You can see here that the same, it's just basically listing all the attested forms. And for a good number of them, there's no plural forms, so where they're collected. So we have Kali here. First one here was 31A. With the suffix, it becomes kel yaka. And notice you get a yod there, and it's got consonantal value because there's a shawa under it. And it's got to be a vocal shawa here because the previous syllable was closed. So kel yaka. And then keli chem for the, there you get the modern form again. But for the light suffixes, that's for the heavy suffix. But for the light suffixes, it gets as well. That's the only attested form, so this is not the best example. But then the plural of Kaleem, and you just had to learn that. Don't really want to predict the plural of that. Puri becomes Piri-yi for the first person form. And then notice you've got two yods there now. The first yod is consonantal, and the second yod is your suffix. And Piri-yaka, excuse me. And peer yeg and peer yol for your second person masculine feminine form and third person masculine singular form. And then for the feminine form, I guess here, yeah, we've got peer yah with a mafik. And for the heavy suffixes, this one is peer yakem. So you still get the consonantal down there. These are all kind of just, you don't know what to do. You don't know what to predict the next form is going to be, exactly what it's going to be like. So that's why they put them all here for you. And then for me, hem, with the hem, it gets the shawa on the yod. With the hem, it doesn't. There's no way to predict that. Okay, and then pir yam, it's the only contested form. Then you've got oni for affliction. And there was, by the way, there's no plural form for fruit. Fruit is a collective kind of thing anyway. So you don't say fruit, it's plural.
Just
like
Galatians 5:22
on the Hebrew. Yeah, the fruit is good. It's probably the same in English. Great good. All right. Anyway, well, oni for affliction, you get oni, and onye. Apparently, those are the only two forms of tested: my affliction and your affliction. That's all there is. All right. Then Kali, you get, or excuse me, Koli, you get Kolyo for the frequent masculine singular, his sickness. And this one, the Kolayim for plural, there is a plural form for that, sicknesses. And then Kasi, good old Kasi, remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
Half. Excuse me. Then you get Ketyo, his half. And Ketyam, their half. It's either their half or half of them, or half of him. I'm not sure which it is.
How many do you think he gained at both humble and dark?
Oh, is it? Oh, okay. Yeah, that'd be just a substantive form then. A substantive form of the book. Sure. A flexible one, something like that, yeah. Okay. Well, that's it. It's a short chapter, but it's got some complications in it. It's nothing really regular, except for the temporal clause is probably the easy part of the chapter. Vocabulary. Zikunim, old age. Plural only in the singular sense. So it's a plural form of the singular sense. Again, this would be a, I don't know what this would be called, a plural extent or something like that. Maybe one of the unusual uses of plural. Kind of a conceptual thing. The air, meaning pit or well. And the construct plural is the arrow. Oni, affliction, we've already seen that, and got the section. Give the full paradigm up here. Verbs, akaz, meaning to keep one's promise or commitment toward, and it's a yip code, just a normal code type imperfect. And it also means to pay attention to visit, to appoint, to pass and review, to muster, by a range of meanings there. Ra, to be bad, this is a verb now. And this is a Geminis type verb, like in section 87 with Tom. Root is ra'ah, or two ayins. That's kind of an interesting Geminis. Geminis, remember, the one that has two, the second and the third radical were the same.
That's probably
exactly like the verb. Yeah, the verb is exactly like the adjective, which generates confusion on occasion, too. So if you look at section 87 on Tom, the assumption is that your paradigm construction is going to be just like Tom. The stated verbs from Gemini roots are inflected as follows in the third person, and the remainder of the question is like Tabah. So, can't really do too much with this verb as far as doubling the ayin, though. I mean, can't put a dogation in it, so I assume it's just with it. It'd be Ra and Ra'ah and Ra'u.
Would that then create the same kind of ambiguity with the doesn't that just mean evil and master?
Yes.
Wrong?
Yes. You would.
You have an ambiguity between the noun and the verb. Mm-hmm. The adjective.
The adjective and the verb.
Whereas the participle and the third person singular.
This might even be considered participle of that verb. This could be considered a stated participle of the verb as whole. It's really hard to say it here. Very possible. I would guess that you would have a compensatory lengthening of the Pratapya Kamas in the forms Ra'a and Ra'u. Can't be sure on the term. They don't get the full paradigm here. Because you can't put the dagesh in the ayin. I would expect the sense for that. Let's see, maybe they give us the verb. A to B. A to B. Oh, that's the adjective one. The A, B category. Did they give anything for B under R? B category is the verbs.
Mm-hmm. No.
They don't? Okay. So we'll just have to guess on that. I would guess, my guess is that there is a sensory lengthening. Well, here, okay. They listen under Ra'a. They listen under a Ra'a. Okay. At nine, at B9D. My guess is right or wrong. I think probably just something entirely different here.
B9D.
I've only got 9D.
That's what I've got.
they do put it under 9C though.
Blank.
And then but they don't give you any more paradigm than they give you a Tom. In Shri 687. So if you still don't have an answer.
They were gonna get around to that, but they didn't.
Okay. Maybe we'll have one of the exercises that'll use the form or something, we can see what it does. Let's hope. Okay.
Black hole in the thing.
Yeah. No, it's just a matter of trying to find the forms. Sometimes the forms aren't attested to the beginning and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, then we've got ta'a, to wander about lost. Probably one you can all relate to. Ta'a, to be depleted, finished at an end.
Those feel good with you.
Yeah, that goes real good with the other one. The progress is setting for a test there. Okay. And then akare kane means afterwards or after this. And Malaka, what's the matter with you? Can you see the logic for that? Can you see the logic for it? What would be looking
what
at
you, what to you?
Yeah, what to you? What to you? What is to you? And so what's with you?
What's with you? Yeah.
Okay, so it's an idiom. I find Hebrew idioms most often very logical, mm-hmm. Even more logical than English ones. So, okay, we've only got a couple minutes here. For tomorrow, go ahead and do A, B, and C, and D on this. And let's go ahead and look at B here. And just translate those. Assume this is going to be, tend to be an oral exercise, but it doesn't mention it that way. Go ahead and write out A and C. A and B, A and C are kind of like what we've seen before, and then D is a reading. So you don't need to write out the reading on D. You just want to use it for your own help. Okay, number one, Cole. What can you read it? Doug?
Onyek.
Onyek. I think the best way to think of this is, yeah, I don't know if you really want to call it, it's more like a rule of Shua, I suppose, because you're getting a Shua now on the Nun and closing the syllable, and it's really hard to say exactly what rule it would really fall under, though. Because even with a even with the rule of Shawa, I suppose I could do it, get the full vowel corresponding to the short vowel. That's probably the best thing. Say the rule of, for example, the rule of Shawa. But usually try to learn these as kind of certain vowel patterns. It's kind of like that, not unlike that Segalit pattern. Certain short vowel pattern. Okay, well, tomorrow we'll finish up on the list. See what we can do with all this.
On that document, it was translated.
Uh-huh.
Are those both sentences?
Yeah, well, I think you have to consider those as continuing the sequence because they're all starting out with simple modifiers. So you can translate them as a sentence pretty much. Just assume that. See, the sequence doesn't have to be a previous part of the sentence. But just assume the sentence that came before this one was either establishing a narrative sequence or a sequence.
Most of the books start that way?
Yeah, some start that way. It's because, yeah, it's not unusual, but a lot of books even start that way as paragraphs and so forth because they are tied into a sequence.
The Hebrew is always in a sequence.
Yeah. In a way, it is.
Yeah.
One big long sequence.
Yeah. None of that. I'm only down 3 games.
And whittle them down.
It's
amazing when you're so close it is. Even the thing like that, to catch up a couple of states. It can really be hard to squeeze it in.
Yeah. Get rough.
It lets you know how busy you really are. There's not much room for any unusual occurrence. It's like with my schedule. Anything that unusual happens, it takes you a couple weeks to recover. You know?
Well, to me, it's unusual occurrences that become the rules of keeping unusual.
Right.
So you just live behind, right? That's what you do. I'm a couple weeks behind.
Always. Couple bricks shy of full load, huh?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that. I don't play a full deck.
Does anybody want to do a research on the Shroud of Turin?
Yeah.
I'll take a look at that. Any need for that? Once anybody is interested in
I thought it was the Shroud of Turin.
Oh, that movie?
This is a digitized.
Film classic? Film classic or something?
This is a digitized photograph from the NASA laboratories. Which is able to pull the full 3-dimensional information off of the clock.
John,
by the way, that they photographed it. I remember reading it.
Huh?
Could they go home and seeing the movie?
Well, I don't know.
I
gotta go take that and give it a few cents out. The only thing I can
do. I'll wait here. One of two things. Quite probably looks like. Somebody, the devil had somebody crucified, and this thing went on, and then had it planted away until it was opportunity. Really, what it looked like. They had a forensic pathologist from Los Angeles examined the shroud and the full scale photograph, and he described the wound. Because of the blood pattern, they even found out down the wrist.
Not down here, but up here.
Right, but they also found. Now they may have found it up here, but what they found was there was two blood traps that ran down, so that there was two positions that the body would hang on.
Mm-hmm.
It would stand up, and the blood would run down this way. It'd slump down and run down this way. So they had two different angles, and if there had been a scalp wound. Detecting the blood stain, the nature of that, and your blood like that, some kind of puncture wound in the side. I mean, this guy, they had the whole thing. He pointed to all the different detailed parts, and there were all these wounds, and this is what it would have done to a piece of cloth laid over the body. But the only problem was that the head, the face, the way this thing was laid, they bound the jaw closed. A thing like you see for a toothache.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And on this picture, in the 3D, it shows a depression around the hair of its horn. It was laid over it. But the cloth was simply a sheath laid down this way and laid over this way. Okay. There was no wrappings at all. Mm-hmm. Or if there were, they were round outside of the sheath. But the way that they give the impression was just laid.
He talks about the napkin laying on the covered head separately with the place.
Wow, it's separate, right? And it talks about these strips. Mm-hmm. You see, they were wrapped around.
Right.
And so, even on that point, you know.
And then the impression there was with long hair, too, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, quite long.
Beard, full beard.
Oh,
and rather short.
And then they had a guy, some Israeli, who did a pollen film. And he found that there was pollen in which is indigenous to Israel. It's not found at the place here. You get down there with an electron microscope and they can't find pollen.
And down there, you know, with material that's been resorted behind
there. I think first popped up.
Yeah, they're here still, I know.
In about somewhere around.
So you're going home with that?
Yeah. Okay, so
please take a look. Yeah,
I saw a bag of tape over there on the wall.
Yeah,
I'm coming to see the impression. You know, it came to the States. I mean, there are